Okay, we're towards the bottom of Yud Aleph Amid Aleph, three lines from the bottom. We ended off with the of Rabbi Yehuda Marav telling us that the curse of a Chacham, even Al Chinam, for apparently nothing, it comes true. And we learned it from the story of Achitofel, where David needed to find out, is he allowed to use the Shem Hashem to be destroyed in order for there not to be this flood? And then Achitofel came up with the Kal Vachomer, and then he told him what to do. Al David, though, initially said, whoever doesn't tell me should be strangled. So, hello. So the commentary has a few interesting things to put out over here. Ritva qualifies this rule by saying that Achitofel was susceptible to the curse because David's suspicions were to a degree correct. Achitofel had not been exerting himself fully to discover the answer. He was therefore not entirely undeserving of a curse. One, however, is entirely guiltless, is impervious to curses for the protection expressed by the verse, like a wandering bird, like a flying swallow, is effective even against the curse of a sage. Remember, we had other psukim that said that curses for nothing don't come true. Mm-hmm, right. That's what we said about the people who were praying that the Kohen Gadol should die. It's not going to come true. So, therefore, when it says chinam, it doesn't mean 100% for nothing. Like, it wasn't that David Bechlal didn't have any cause. In other words, David knew that Achitofel, like, why wasn't Achitofel trying to help him? He knows Achitofel's smart, and if Achitofel would put his mind to it, he'd come up with a solution. And why isn't he offering one to David? So it really wasn't like, so David finally, you know, says, listen, whoever doesn't tell me this is going to get this. It means I'm already upset with you, Achitofel. Mm. So although it wasn't a direct curse to Achitofel, it was somewhat related to Achitofel's lackadaisical attitude towards helping out what was going on over there. So therefore, it may appear to have been chinam. So when it says a curse for chinam, for nothing, meaning if it appears to be for chinam, it could still come true. But if it was totally no cause at all, then that should not come true. Now, that answers that question. Also, why should it be when a Talmud Chacham makes a curse on condition and it doesn't even come true? Why should it come true? Now, there's a technical issue here. The account of the exchange between David and Achitofel was puzzling. David did not purchase the temple site from Aravna the Yavusi until after he sinned by counting the people. And that took place 3 years after Achitofel's death. So how could this story take place? Yeah. Right? That he said he's digging at the temple's foundations. How would he be doing that? He hasn't bought it yet. Perforce, we must say, though, David did not purchase the field until years later. He had known the intended site since his youth when he was anointed by Shmuel. At that time, David and Shmuel studied the book of Yeshua until they located the temple site. And that's alluded to in Tehillim. So knowing where the temple would be built, David secured Aravna's permission to dig its foundations even before he purchased the area. Okay, there's other interpretations. Okay, that takes care of that issue as well. Okay, so that's the first halacha that Rabbi Yehuda Marav says, that a curse, if it has a little bit of credence, we'll say, will come true. Okay, now we come to another case. Now, it's interesting. So this statement, first statement was, a curse of a chachmam afilu bechinam. So now Rabbi Bo is going to say a statement relatively similar, a slight difference, and definitely a different personality. Amar Rabbi Bo, Rabbi Bo gives another principle regarding a curse, almost the same. Kilal aschinam, the curse of a chacham, afilu al tenai he ba. Even on condition, it comes true. The first statement was kilal aschacham afilu bechinam. Even for apparently nothing comes true. Now he's saying it on condition, and even if the condition is not met, it's a conditional curse. Even though the condition wasn't met, it will still come true. Min olin, how do we learn this? Me'eli, from Eli. Remember, Eli was the last of the Shoftim, right? And who was the one who succeeded Eli? Was Shmuel. Shmuel Navi. Oh, really, he was the last of the Shoftim. He's the transitional one, we'll say. Now, what's going on there? Remember that Shmuel, a couple times, when Shmuel was a young fellow, and he was living in the temple, the Mishkan, and he heard voices calling for him. So he thought it was Eli calling him. So he went to Eli and he said, I'm not calling you. So Eli figured out that Hashem is starting to give prophecy to Shmuel. So Eli said, the next time you hear yourself called, say, I'm listening, I'm ready, and then Hashem will speak to you, and I want you to tell me the message. Mm-hmm. Right? And let's see what happens following that. And then the Kamerle Eli Shmuel, and then Eli said to Shmuel, regarding that prophecy, when Shmuel got that prophecy, it was a scary prophecy. It was a prophecy saying that Eli's sons and Eli were going to die, and they're going to be cursed, the family's going to be cursed, this and that. Bad things were going to happen. So when Eli realized that Shmuel got this prophecy, and he was not aware of what the prophecy was, Shmuel was aware, so he said a curse, a conditional curse. He said, Ko yaseh lecha Elokim, so shall Hashem do to you, v'cho yosif, and so he shall continue, im sechached mimene dover, if you conceal anything from me. Okay, now, what did he mean by that? Let's add a little bit more. Eli's curse is that whatever had befallen Eli should befall Shmuel as well. Okay? And Eli kind of knew. He knew he didn't have children that were virtuous. He knew that himself. So that meant to say, just as Eli's sons are not virtuous, so too should Shmuel's sons not be virtuous. Okay? So the curse was conditional. If you don't tell me the prophecy, this should happen. Okay? Now, that was what the prophecy was about, that Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, would die, and that all of Eli's descendants would then die at the young age of 18. Okay? So, that was a curse he gave him, and it was a conditional curse. So, what did Shmuel do? Shmuel told him everything he wanted to know. He told him everything. And even though the pasuk says, Vayagid li Shmuel es kol advarim v'lo chichad mimenu, and Shmuel told him all the things that he wanted to know. He didn't withhold anything from him. So that was that. Now we go fast forward many years later as Shmuel gets older. V'afilu hachiksev, but still it writes later on about Shmuel's sons. V'lo holchubanav bidrachav. Shmuel's sons did not go in his ways. So the curse of Eli came to pass, just like the sons of Eli were not virtuous, so too his children were not virtuous. Okay? So it's interesting. It says, and they turned, the sons of Eli, it says, and they turned toward gain, and they took bribes, and they bent justice. So they really weren't such great guys. They abused their position of power. And Ramban says that Eli should have formally removed the curse after Shmuel revealed information. Since he didn't, was fulfilled, this implies that if a conditional curse is removed, it poses no danger. Presumably the same is true of an undeserved curse. So the question then becomes, well, why didn't he do that? All right, so that's another discussion that we're going to have to look into that.
How does he remove the curse?
Well, you just say, take off the curse. Okay.
An earlier vow or something.
Well, that, yeah, it's like I take it off. All right, we'll have to get back to you on that and see why that came out, that happens. Yeah?
Just like in the previous example, though, there was some sort of blame left for Achitovel to take in the curse. What was it like, you know?
That's what we have to look into that. Yeah. I'll get back to you tomorrow on that, Mirza Shem. Okay, but that's a problem. I mean, what did Shmuel do? I mean, you could... You know, that's just what it is. He did what he did. So, what?
Yeah.
Okay, next point. Another case of a little different type of condition. Amri Huda Marav. Nidui Al Tanai. Sora Chafara. If someone excommunicates somebody, and that's based on a condition, right? Even if the condition's not been met, here we're saying the ban has to be formally annulled. Okay? What's that? What's the whole idea over here? A person who's been placed under a nidui, a ban of excommunication, what does that imply? Is ostracized by the community in a variety of ways. He must conduct himself personally as if he were in the 7 days of mourning. Okay? And the Rambam gives 24 things you could do to deserve nidui. Mm-hmm. Okay? So now how do you get rid of it? You annul it. Okay? It must be annulled by the one who pronounced it or by anyone of equal stature. I mean, it does come off. You don't expect the guy to stay that state forever. The more
anybody can annul?
Not anybody. You got to be a big scholar. Not me or you. Nobody around.
Stature. What does it mean?
A big rabbi. A big, big rabbi.
Or by one of equals, which means not the one that places the curse.
No. Again, a nidui can only be given by a very big rabbi to begin with.
Right.
And therefore, it could only be removed either by that rabbi or someone of an equal stature
to him. So it could be somebody else that didn't place the curse.
Yes, it has to be annulled. Yeah, it has to be annulled. Okay.
Story.
Now, it's Gemara teaches that even a conditional ban whose condition was not met, right, still needs an annulment. Okay. Alrighty. So, yeah. So that's the point, to take it off. And where are we going to learn that from? Minola mi Yehuda. We learned that from Yehuda. What was the ban on Yehuda? Dichsiv. So, it says regarding what Yehuda said to Yaakov. Really, it seems Yehuda gave the ban upon himself when he wanted to bring Binyamin down to Egypt, and Yaakov did not want that to happen. So Yehuda says the following ban, as it were, on condition. And he says, Imlo haviosi velech, etc. If I don't bring it back to you, if I don't bring Binyamin back to you, then I will have sinned to you for all time. And that's an expression of a ban. If I don't bring him back, I should be banned for all time in this world and in the next world. Now he accepted the ban only if he doesn't bring Binyamin back. But he did bring him back safely. And what do we see happened? Well, for all time, he had this ban. V'ramer Shmuel bar Nechmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonason, he tells us, Ma'i dechsiv, let's go now to the end of the Torah. Moshe's brachas that he gave Yehuda were more than just simple brachas. It says, Yechi Ruvain v'al yamos. Ruvain should live and not die. V'zos li Yehuda. And this is for Yehuda, etc., etc. So what's going on? So why does Moshe give Yehuda a blessing immediately after Reuven is the question. Why does Yehuda's blessing commence with the expression, and this is for Yehuda? Well, what's the problem? Instead of following the regular birth order, the blessing should have been, because before Moshe dies, he blesses all the tribes, start with Reuven, then Shimon, Levi, etc. He goes from Reuven to Yehuda. Okay? Also, it's the only bracha that begins with the word vizos, and this. Okay, so what kind of blessing is this? So now we found out some interesting details. Kol osan mem shana shayisol b'midbar. All 40 years that the Jews were in the desert, atzama shal Yehuda hayem megugolim ba'aron. The bones of Yehuda in the coffin were rolling around in the coffin. They weren't sitting still. Okay, in other words, his skeleton was no longer intact. The remains of all his brothers, by contrast, were intact. In other words, if a skeleton's intact, it's not rolling around. If it's not intact, they decomposed, they separated one bone from another, they're rolling around in the coffin when they're carrying it. The Jews carried all the 12 tribes, their ancestor, back to Israel. So, etc. So his bones were rolling, which was not good, right? It's like a punishment. Ad she'amad Moshe b'gashol rachem, until Moshe got up and was asking Hashem for mercy on him. Amar lefanav. So Moshe said to Hashem, Ribbono shel Olam. Now you can see the connection between the bracha that was first given to Reuven and then right to Yehuda. He says, Mi gorem l'Reuven shiyoda. Who caused Reuven to confess his sin? Okay. When he switched the beds and things like that with Bilhah's bed and Yaakov's tent. And Reuven did tshuva on that. Who caused Reuven to do tshuva? Yehuda. Yehuda was the one. Had he not heard Yehuda's confession of his sins, he wouldn't have done that either. And that's the story with Yehuda and Tamar. Okay, that whole story with Yehuda and Tamar, we're not going to review it all. But Yehuda wanted to have Tamar burnt because he thought she was acting immorally. And then he confessed in front of everybody that he was the father of the child. So that confession prompted Reuven to confess his sin as well. So therefore, that's the connection between the two of them. And therefore, you got to take that into account. This is all the commentary. We can skip all this. So Rabbi Yonah's son, he has a tradition that Yehuda's confession influenced Reuven to confess as well. Okay, so therefore, okay, that's all that, etc., etc. Okay, so therefore, Moshe's opening words, "May Reuven live," intimate that Reuven's remains were intact as though he were still alive. Okay, that's what he said before, "May Reuven live." So they all came from Yehuda. So he's saying, so listen, who got Reuven to do tshuva? That's Yehuda. So therefore, you know, give him a break, right? So in other words, if when Reuven confessed his sin and Reuven's skeleton's intact, so why shouldn't Yehuda's skeleton be intact? Right? That's coming up. So that's what it, Vizos li Yehuda, and this is for Yehuda? It's question mark. You understand what's going on over here? He's saying, this is what Yehuda gets? He gets Reuven to confess, and Reuven's skeleton is intact, and Yehuda's skeleton should not be intact for the sin that he did? Right? So if Reuven's confession earns him life in the world to come, and Yehuda's the one who caused him to do that, why should Yehuda be suffering that? Mm-hmm. Okay, that was Moshe's request. So now we continue with the blessings now. Shema Hashem, call Yehuda. Listen, Hashem, to the voice of Yehuda. So allow his remains to find rest in the coffin. That's the next part of the pasuk over here. So that's what happened. So guess what? After Moshe said that, O'el Ivrei L'Shafa. So Yehuda's Ivrei limbs, O'el, entered into their joints. It got back good. It got back together over there. However, not enough. But Lohava Koma Aliale L'Mesiftu Rekia. But they didn't allow Yehuda to come into the heavenly yeshiva. Okay, so now his bones found rest. But this is all from the ban that Yehuda self-imposed upon himself that was on condition. That's what we're bringing this all in. Yehuda made the ban on himself.
Yeah.
And the bet, and he didn't, what do you call it? He didn't annul it. And it was on condition. So you see, it comes true. So then Moshe said, but wait a minute. So his bones are intact, but he still doesn't get into the yeshiva above. In heaven, he's not allowed entrance into yeshiva above. So that's the next words of Moshe's bracha. Velamo tevienu, and you shall bring him to his people. Okay, so that prayer was accepted too. Now he's getting to the yeshiva in the heaven above. Fine, but just being in yeshiva doesn't mean you get too much rights in the yeshiva. But lo hava koyada le mishka lo mitrach b'shmeitz about the rabbanan. But he didn't know how to debate the law with the rabbis. He wasn't on the level of the sages. So unless he didn't wasn't smart enough, whatever, so he couldn't partake in the discussion. So now Moshe adds the next words: Yadav Rav Lo. May his hands fight for him, contend for him. In other words, he should be able to engage in Talmudic debate. So that prayer was accepted as well. Okay, but the problem still was Lo Hava Yada La Faruke Kusha, but he didn't know how to answer the challenges that other rabbis raised to what he was saying. Okay, so he wasn't winning the arguments. So then Moshe prayed the next words, Ve'ezer, you shall help him, Mitzarav, from his adversaries, he should be. He should have the proper counter arguments. Okay, now really, this is way more than the ban already. Right? Although Yehuda proclaimed his ban only if he should not bring Binyam back to his father, and he did bring him back. He was under the ban until Moshe prayed for his annulment. Oh, so we see that the conditional one comes true. Whoa, let's see what Tosfos has to say here. Tosfos qualifies this whole thing. An unfulfilled conditional ban takes effect only in a case like Yehuda's, where the ability to keep his promise was never in his own hands. What did he say? If I don't bring Binyamin back. Now, is that in his control necessarily?
No.
No, he could try all he wants. If if Yosef doesn't let him bring him back, something has to be in your control, right? Sin was not in Yehuda's power to prevent the condition from being fulfilled. It was as if he made no condition at all. You understand the difference? In other words, you're making condition. If I say, let's say something that you're totally in control. If I don't learn a page of Gemara today, I should be a ban on me. And I have a whole day to do it. Well, then it's my fault. But for me to bring him back, well, wait a minute. Binyamin is already incarcerated by somebody else. So when you're making that condition, it's not a condition that you're in control of. So it's as if you gave the ban without a condition, because it's not in your control. Therefore, the ban took effect at the moment it was uttered. You see? Because it's not your control already. Ordinarily, however, one is able to control whether the condition of a ban will be fulfilled. For example, if the court issues a ban against a person to take effect if he performs a certain act, it's in his power to refrain from the act. For example, there was, I don't want to get political now, but in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim, you're talking about the early 1900s, or really late 1800s, where there was very Haredi, the old Yishuv, the initial Yishuv. This is before the secular Zionists really took over the country. But there was already influences. So in the early 1800s, like, the only schools were Haredi schools. They only taught you Torah. That's all there is. The early, going back to early Zionists, the students of the Vilna Gaon, those were just to know your history, not to be misled. Okay? The early Zionists were Haredim only, and they were all students of the Vilna Gaon. Those are the Haredim. That's why a lot of the customs in Yerushalayim now are based on the Vilna Gaon. Okay? Then all of a sudden, secular people started getting in. They started influencing. They started opening up schools that were totally, that started off just a little bit, just to learn a little math and a little science. But the rabbis knew right away it's not going to end up with a little math and a little science. It's going to be the end of with no Torah at all, as it was. So the rabbis would, and then all of a sudden there were some of the Haredim were being a little influenced by this. So the big rabbis like Rav Shmuel Salant, people like that said, anybody who goes to these schools, sends their kids to schools, they will be under a ban. Okay? They'll be under a ban. You're excommunicated from our community. And most people didn't want to cross the rabbis there, and they would not go. But there'd be one or two that the ban went on. So that's a good example of what he's saying over here. So it's in your control. The condition is, or like they go to that, if you're going to send your kids to that modern school, you're under a ban. So that's the condition. So the guy says, no, that's totally under his control. So that's when we say that wouldn't take effect, that kind of a condition, because it's in your control.
And bans are always
Therefore, the ban does not take effect automatically, but only if he actually performs the forbidden act. You see the difference over there. While over here, when Yehuda said, if I don't bring him back, well, it's not in your control. So basically, the assumption is he ain't coming back, and therefore the ban takes effect immediately. Now it needs someone to take it off. How? If he brings Yosef back, he should have taken it off. That's the point. So that's one way of looking at it. Ritva suggests that the ban afflicted Yehuda because he did not fulfill his promise to the letter. Although Binyamin was safe, he said, I have to return him. Yehuda did not physically return him to Yaakov as he had promised, but left him in Egypt with Yosef. He said, Abba, if I don't bring him back to you, and he said, if I don't stand him up before you. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what happened? He didn't bring him back. Technically, it accomplished the same thing. He procured his release. He was safe. But he didn't actually bring him back. So therefore, to some measure, the ban still took effect. Had Yehuda fulfilled the promise of the letter, the ban notwithstanding its conditional nature would not have come to fruition. On the other hand, there's others who say Yehuda did bring Binyamin back to Yaakov. So machlokes, if Yehuda brought Binyamin back as well. So that's the second answer to the question.
He
brought Yaakov, but he didn't. But it's a machlokes. Some say he actually did bring back Binyamin. So that's how you're going to interpret the psukim. The Archaim qualifies this rule differently. He writes that Yehuda's stipulation lacked the doubling that defines a legally valid stipulation that we learned from this week's Parsha. What's this week's Parsha? Matos Masse, what's in Parshas Matos? When Reuven and God wanted the portion of land on the east bank, Moshe makes this condition, and he says, only if you go and you lead into battle can you get this, and if you don't, he said both sides of the coin, so to make a proper ban, it has to be doubled. Right? So Yehuda's stipulation lacked the doubling that defines a legally valid stipulation. Right? It should have said also, and if I do bring you back, then etc. Thus, the condition was invalid. Therefore, the ban took effect even though the condition had not been met. Had the correct formula been used? He just said, if I don't bring it back, but he didn't say the positive side. Now, look at this. A sage who...
implied in his thing?
No, you got to double it, just like vows.
Yeah.
Vows work the same. You got to say both sides of the coin. A sage who plays a ban about himself may annul it himself. So the question is, why then did Yehuda not annul his own ban? Ritva answers that whereas one can annul a ban that affects only himself, one cannot annul a ban that enforces his promise to another, which was to Yaakov. Others wonder why Yaakov did not. Why did Yaakov not annul Yehuda's ban? One answer that a ban that takes effect in the next world can be annulled only by the Almighty himself. But Rashba disagrees. He maintains that a sage annulment uproots a ban retroactively. After annulment, then, it is as if the ban had never been made. Thus, annulment is effective even with respect to the next world. Rashba says Yehuda thought annulment unnecessary since he had fulfilled the condition bringing Yaakov back to Binyamin, back to Yaakov. Okay, so there's all kinds of answers why that indeed came true. Okay, fine. Now, last section, we're going to hit it to the Mishnah now. So that was these three little digressions, curses, bans, etc., etc. Now, here's a question you guys were asking when we learned this halacha. Ibailahu, we come back to the inadvertent killer and the death of the Kohen Gadol, and this is the question you all asked. Ibailahu, the Gemara asked the following shaila. When it says he goes back with the death of the Kohen Gadol, and we listed 3-4 Kohen Gadols, so is it B'misas Kulan who goes there? Does he return when all of them who are alive die? O Dilma B'misas Echad Mehem, or maybe only with one of them that dies? That's the question. So let's say a case where all three Kohanim were alive at the same time. Now, obviously, if only one of them is alive, there's no question. But all three, and that's very possible. So more wish to determine whether all who exist must die, or if the death of one alone is sufficient.
Right?
If, however, only one Kohen exists, there's no question his death returns the killer's home. The lack of the two Kohanim cannot condemn the killer to a love thing. Well, there isn't the other two types of Kohanim, and since they're not going to die, you can never leave. That doesn't make sense. Interestingly, but the Aruch HaNer disagrees. He maintains that the point of the inquiry is to determine whether the death of all three types of Kohanim is a necessary criterion for freedom. According to the inquiry, applies also where only one type of Kohen Gadol exists, and therefore he'll never get to leave. If the deaths of all three are required, the exiles do not return. If it's not required, they return with the death of the existing Kohen. So that's the machlokas over here.
Does not result.
No, we're going to get the answer in a minute.
Okay.
Another part of the question, wow, lots of discussion over here. Where are you up to here? The inquiry also, remember, there was one opinion, there was three coins, and then Rabbi Yehuda added another one, the anointed one.
Yeah.
The inquiry also concerns Rabbi Yehuda allows exiles to return with the death of the anointed for battle. Does he permit return upon the death of any one of these four Kohanim, or does he require the death of all four? So it's an extra person in the question. Okay? So that's the basic issue over. So that's the question. Gemara is going to want to bring a proof from the next Mishnah, and they're going to refute the proof from the next Mishnah. Tashma, come and hear a proof from the next Mishnah that we'll learn tomorrow. It says like this, Nigmar Dino Belo Kohen Gadol. Let's say you have the fellow who killed inadvertently, and he is judged in the court that he has to go to exile. But while he was being judged, at the time, there was no Kohen Gadol at all. We were in between. That can happen. You could have a Kohen Gadol dying, and then from the time we anoint the next Kohen Gadol, maybe it takes a few hours. And at that time, right then and there, he was judged to be an inadvertent killing. There's two different things going on. You have this Sanhedrin, let's say, who's Asa is making a judgment. And the timing was 4 o'clock on this day, we pronounce that he's an inadvertent killer. The Kohen Gadol died at 1 o'clock. No one's not appointed till 6 o'clock. So now if there's no Kohen Gadol, what's the law?
Can sit without a Kohen Gadol.
Yeah, you don't need a Kohen Gadol.
You don't need him. Okay.
It's not even the Sanhedrin. It's just a court of 23.
Yeah.
Any court of 23 can do this.
Okay.
So Eina Yotzei Misham Leolam. The Mishnah says he can never leave. Because it's only if the Kohen Gadol was appointed prior to the killer's sentence.
Yeah.
You know? But till then, he can't. We'll discuss that more when we get to that Mishnah. There's a lot of questions to ask on that, but that's clear if it's a Kohen Gadol. Now, wait a minute. But if you say that it has to be with all three, the Im Issa, now if it's true that the killer is released upon the death of any one of the three, then what does it matter that Kohen Gadol's not there? Lihadar Bei Bedahanach, let him go back with the death of another one. In other words, what do you mean to say there's no Kohen Gadol? What are the options of Kohen Gadols? You have a Kohen Gadol who was a regular Kohen Gadol. Then you have a Kohen Gadol who is removed from office temporarily because he was filling in for somebody, right? Then you have the Kohen Mashiach Melchama, Kohen Rabbi Yehuda. So what does it mean if there was no Kohen Gadol? There's always some kind of Kohen Gadol around, right? Let him return upon the death of the other ones, right? The fact that he's not returned proves that all three have to die. Now, there's a big assumption in the Gemara's question. Gemara assumes that the Mishnah quoted refers to the primary Kohen Gadol, the anointed one who serves in the Holy Temple. He was not around when the inadvertent killer was sentenced. Mm-hmm. It speaks of a case where this sort of Kohen Gadol does not exist time of sentencing. The other sorts of Kohen Gadol, however, let's say those garbed in additional vestments or those who stepped down from garments, may forever have been in existence at the time. So we're saying he can't go back if that Kohen Gadol dies. Well, what about the others, right? Let him go back with the others. So it must be a proof that you got to have all three.
All three. Wow.
The answer is no. That case of omission could be Bedaleka, where there weren't any other Kohanim at the time. Mm-hmm. There weren't any more. If there would have existed another one, then he could have gone back with one. You don't need all three. So the Mishnah says, all right, if his sentence was handed down when there was no Kohen Gadol, it means that none of the three types were to be found. You can learn it that way. So it could have been any one, but since none of them were to be found,
they're not around.
The Gemara does not mean that the Mishnah is definitely speaking of this case. It's simply different said that nothing can be proved from the Mishnah since it might be speaking of this case. Thus, the inquiry is not resolved. We wanted to say, oh, well, there's other Kohanim. Why can't he leave? Must be, got to wait till they all die. Who says that's a case? Not a proof. Alternately, the Gemara means that this is definitely the Mishnah's case. Some say that is the case. If so, we may infer from the Mishnah that where there are other Kohanim still in existence, the death of even a single one would free the killer. According to this understanding, the inquiry is resolved. So Machlokas is resolved. The final law, and you look in the Rambam, look over there. The Rambam clearly says, is he going to give me the Rambam? No, he's not giving me the Rambam, so I don't know why I even touched that. Now I'm going to have trouble getting back. Okay, not so much. Bidaleka. So we're saying that, and therefore, and the halacha is that if one Kohen Gadol dies, he goes back. That's how we paskin. So it's a machlokas, how the Gemara concluded here. Was it not resolved or yes resolved? Either way, the halacha is one Kohen Gadol, he does leave. Okay.